You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of September 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Chloe Potter.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes,
Russia analyst, author, and Monocle regular Ben Judah joins us today in the studio to set the day's agenda. Ben, what do you have for us today?
Vladimir Putin's message to the American people, just published in the New York Times, a plea for caution. Is this a bold move by Putin or one of the most sophisticated pieces of Russian disinformation since the Cold War? I've got what the consequences will be as Putin wins big abroad of him losing Russia's fourth city, Yekaterinburg, to the opposition, and whether or not Putin's standing in the Russian elite has been badly damaged by the failure of his ruling party, United Russia, to kind of cleanly win the election in Moscow versus the charismatic opposition leader, Alexei Navalny.
Great stuff, Ben. We'll look forward to that. And after a series of prisoner exchanges between Pakistan and Afghanistan designed to boost the peace process in the region, we ask if it's brought the Taliban and Afghan government any closer to reconciliation.
Plus, we'll be visiting a London neighbourhood where the inventive use of public space is engaging the local community.
So the structure is a civic folly on wheels. It's basically a tiny little town hall built out of fake bricks. It's 3 metres tall. It's got a clock tower on the top. It's got beautiful ornate guttering, it's got a bright pink bicycle, it's bicycle powered, and bright pink doors on the back.
We'll also take a tour of the gardens of Kyoto with Dutch visual artist Jacqueline Hassink.
There is no difference between private and public because the sliding doors, they open and there are no windows and there is sort of no border. So I thought conceptually this is a really interesting type of space.
All that, plus we round up the news from Mali, we'll review this morning's Italian front pages, and we may even play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. So, a very busy 60 minutes up ahead, but before all that, here is Mr. Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The five permanent members of the UN Security Council have been meeting in New York to discuss a Russian plan for neutralizing Syria's chemical weapons. Diplomats say early discussions on resolutions have begun as the nations attempt to find common ground. Syria has backed the Russian plan to place the chemical arms under international control. The US says it will hold off military strikes to pursue diplomacy. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and the US Secretary of State John Kerry will hold bilateral talks in Geneva later today. Austin Long, professor at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University, told the Monocle Daily that Russia's proposals have yet to be made public.
Whatever plan is proposed, there are going to be a lot of challenges that have to be worked through in great detail. I mean, if you're going to secure weapons on bases, for example, how do you ensure that those bases in Syria aren't attacked by rebels? On the other hand, if you think about moving the chemical weapons, how are you going to ensure that the rebels don't attack the convoys as they move? So there's going to be a great deal of nitty-gritty work that needs to be done on these plans, whatever they are.
And the International Committee of the Red Cross is calling on the United States and Russia to discuss the obstacles to delivering aid in Syria. ICRC President Peter Maurer says their work's being hampered by Syrian government forces and opposition rebels.
We also need the attention, the diplomatic and political attention from the international community, so that each and everyone who has an influence on one side or the other in Syria is supporting neutral and impartial humanitarian actors like the ICRC and others, so that we can do the job we are supposed to do, deliver humanitarian aid to people in need.
At least six soldiers have been killed in a double suicide bomb attack in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Officials say another 10 soldiers and 7 civilians were wounded by the blasts outside the military intelligence headquarters in Rafah and at a nearby checkpoint. Military staff are blaming what they call Islamist terrorist elements for the violence. Hundreds of candlelight vigils have been held across Chile to honour the thousands who were killed or who disappeared after a violent military coup ushered in General Augusto Pinochet's brutal dictatorship 40 years ago. Relatives of some of the more than 3,000 people who disappeared, presumed killed by Pinochet's military government, lit candles outside Santiago's infamous Londres 38, one of the hundreds of secret sites of torture, execution and disappearance. A vigil was also held outside Santiago's National Stadium, a site used by Pinochet's government to hold thousands of political prisoners. The annual tribute to the victims of the September the 11th attacks has been lighting up the skies over New York. The city commemorated the 12th anniversary of the attacks with tribute lights sent from Ground Zero. Two beams of light rose up as a symbol of the Twin Towers that were lost 12 years ago and in remembrance of the nearly 3,000 people who died on that day. The tribute in lights is seen each year from sunset on September the 11th to sunrise on September the 12th. The anti-Islam pastor Terry Jones has been arrested on a felony charge in Florida after announcing plans to burn nearly 3,000 copies of the Quran on a barbecue grill to mark the 12th anniversary of 9/11. Jones was towing the grill and the kerosene-soaked holy books in the back of his pickup truck to a park in Mulberry in Florida. Jones and a supporter were each charged with unlawful conveyance of fuel, which is a felony. And Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd says Jones was also charged with a misdemeanor of openly carrying a firearm.
When Terry got out of the car, he was openly carrying a firearm, which is a violation of law. He does have a concealed firearms permit, but he was openly carrying the firearm, and that was observed by several deputies.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. It's 8:06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You are listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Chloe Potter. It's time now to set the day's news agenda. Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin, joins us this morning in the studio. Welcome to the program, Ben. Let's begin, though, in your area of specialty, of course, Russia. On Tuesday night, we saw President Barack Obama address the nation from the White House. Vladimir Putin doing his own little bit of PR this time, though, through the New York Times.
Well, it's important in understanding Putin's psychology that Putin considers himself a judo master and that he likes to play judo to relax. And the concept of judo is to turn your opponent's strength against him. And Putin has seen right through the inconsistencies and the weaknesses in Obama, Cameron and Kerry's plan to launch incredibly small missile attacks on Syria. And he's managed to turn the inconsistency of this policy into a way to make him look like not only the leader of an international alliance of the anti-war forces of the world from Beijing to Brasilia via New Delhi, but also like he's got better intelligence. And today in the New York Times, Putin is trying to play on the fear in the pro-strikes campaign in the US about is this good or is this bad for Israel by warning that his intelligence, that the rebels that launched the so-called fake gas strike, blaming it on Assad's forces, are plotting another attack, this time in the direction of Israel, and that he's just sort of letting people know in the op-ed columns of the New York Times.
He is very much playing his favourite role, isn't he, of alpha male hero in all of this?
Well, it's important to understand that 10 years ago, when Blair and Bush and Chirac were strutting the globe and sending their emissaries to the UN Security Council, Putin was in power. And Putin remembers every step of the war, the path to war in Iraq, when Russia felt humiliated, ignored, had no strong alliances with China, with India, with Iran, in order to be able to block that. So as Obama tries to learn the lessons of Iraq, Putin is applying them. And those lessons are sell your message in the US, within the US, look strong, and try and be the brave spokesman of the rest against the West. And this, he's done it pretty well. And he does
do quite a compelling job with this argument. You know, reading through it, he really does pull on some of the heartstrings that I think Americans can relate to. He says this is not a fight for democracy. This is a sectarian battle. The Americans should not be getting involved in these, internal conflicts in foreign countries and get kind of bogged down. So he is making a very strong case here, isn't he?
Indeed. And it's important to realise that as leaders lose support at home, they tend to throw themselves into foreign policy where the glamour and the glitz of international summits substitutes in the sadness of like losing elections and being unable to deliver healthcare reform benefits. And for Putin, this is crucial because Putin has, over the past couple of years, especially in the past 6 months, come under a lot of flack within the Russian elite because of he's been losing the public. There's been a wave of mayoral elections in Russia, and United Russia's done very badly. The preparations for the Sochi Olympics have gone down disastrously with a $50 billion price tag, the most expensive Olympics ever, the cost of the last three combined. Very little to show for it so far. And PR campaigns designed to legitimise himself at home, such as the kind of anti-gay legislation, that's tarnished Russia's image beyond belief. So for Putin, being able to look like the first Russian leader that stopped America punching out a regime since the Cold War is a huge selling point. So he's going for it with kind of full thrust.
And turning to those mayoral elections on the domestic front, Ben, there's been a significant defeat of Putin in Russia's fourth biggest city. Tell us about that.
Ekaterinburg is the capital of the Urals. It's Russia's fourth biggest city. It's 1.5 million people. And in a way, it's become Russia's protest capital over the past 5 years. A lot of opposition activity, a lot of civil society activism there. And in the latest mayoral elections wave, and it's important to say that these are only so-called elections because the opposition isn't given access to TV, the opposition isn't allowed to protest freely, it's not allowed to get proper funding. Putin's candidate was beaten by the opposition. This gentleman is called Yevgeny Roizman, and even though he may be opposition, that doesn't mean he's in any way palatable to the West or indeed to Russia's Democrats. He's a fierce nationalist and he's also Jewish. He's anti-Putin, but he's also a kind of crime-fighting vigilante that runs a series of heroin so-called camps in the countryside around Ekaterinburg, where heroin junkies are abducted, then sent to, then chained to beds with handcuffs, and forced onto a cold turkey regime because he doesn't believe in modern medicine. And when they've like recovered to a sufficient moment to be put to work, they're sent to restore churches and do other charitable acts for the local population.
And Ben, this character won.
He won.
Ironically enough, it seems the Kremlin's backing of his opponent was so unsubtle that it actually put voters off.
Well, the Kremlin is terrified of Mr. Roizman because he, when I've spent time with him, he has this sort of Bill Clinton effect. And he's incredibly popular in the Urals. They would vote him into the Kremlin itself. Because where the Putin's governors have not been doing very much apart from kind of hosting mega complexes and building stadiums and kind of stealing billions, Mr. Roizman has been doing what people really, really want done, which is fighting the war on drugs, literally, with gangs of vigilantes roaming the streets, beating up kind of drug dealers. And crucially, he's managed to outplay Putin on all of the macho nationalist angles because he believes, and he's told me, that for him, the war on drugs, it's the war on the gypsies.
And of course, this ties in quite brilliantly with last weekend's mayoral elections in Moscow. Although the Kremlin-backed candidate did win Sobyanin, it was Alexei Navalny who did much better than I think most analysts and even leading opposition figures would have expected. He gained something like 20, 25, 30% in that vote. Is this a bit of a renaissance for Russia's opposition?
Navalny's campaign has been kind of characterised by a series of miracles. Firstly, about 6-7 months ago, his narrative was looking very lost. The glow of heroism about him was epic. And then Putin decided that it was about time that he was sent to jail. The whole drama of the trial, which was a mix between a show trial and a Soviet distance trial that Navalny managed to steal. Instead of being humiliated, he became the hero of the play designed to besmirch him. Saw him his star rise dramatically in Russia. And he, when the very day he was sentenced to 5 years in jail, there was weeping outside the courtroom. A rush of protesters outside the Russian parliament frightened someone in the Kremlin. He was suddenly released, so miracle number one. Miracle number two was that even though this is called an election, it's not an election because the opposition are not given access to TV, they're not allowed to protest as they want, they're not allowed to raise money. Any oligarch or major businessman that would consider giving enough funds has been chased, has been either humiliated, warned that they could lose their businesses. The gentleman that wrote Navalny's campaign manifesto has been chased out of the country, whereas the government candidate had state TV, all workers in hospitals, schools, employees of the state told to vote for him. And he, despite all of this, he did incredibly badly. 75% of Moscovites didn't even turn out to vote. So the so-called Putin majority is a majority of the apathetic, or a majority of the indifferent. And out of that percentage of people that had come out to vote, barely half of them voted for the pro-regime candidate. And the only way that he got a majority was because of two sort of technologies to rig the vote. One is that the borders of Moscow were radically expanded to include sleepy commuter towns, some 30 or 40 kilometres outside. So it's the equivalent of including Luton in or Stansted into the London mayoral election. Completely different worlds, places where you can be far more repressive, places with a completely different character. The second was a sudden surge of postal voting. Never really been fashionable in Russia, but a wave of pro-Sobyanin postal votes, with Sobyanin winning the postal vote by 90%. So it's clear to everyone in Moscow and within the Russian elite, more crucially, that if Navalny had been allowed to campaign freely, he would be mayor of Moscow right now.
That's the thing, isn't it? Despite all those obstacles, as you say, the voice of the opposition is still audible in Russia. Ben Judah, thanks so much for joining us, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Thanks very much.
Up next, after this very short break, we'll be putting the Pakistan-Taliban relationship under the microscope and finding out if peace could soon be on the horizon.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 12:18 in Islamabad. It is 8:18 here in London. Now, since American troops moved into Afghanistan after the attacks of September 11th, the Taliban have been on the run, many of them escaping into parts of neighboring Pakistan. The country has seen a startling rise in the number of Taliban-related attacks and of an insurgency that has threatened the relatively fragile stability of the country.
But in a bid to foster slightly warmer relations, a trust-building exercise of sorts is underway ahead of possible peace talks. There have been reports that the two sides have swapped prisoners, with the Pakistanis handing over six members of the Taliban and two paramilitary fighters. So is this a sign of progress towards the long-sought peace talks? Rob Crilly, The Telegraph's Pakistan correspondent, joins us on the line now from Islamabad. And Shashank Joshi is research fellow for the Royal United Services Institute, and he joins us in the studio as our expert on the region this morning. Rob, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
What is the significance of these recent prisoner exchanges?
Well, there are two sets of prisoner exchanges we're talking about here. The first that has been going on for the past 7 or 8 months is the release of Afghan Taliban prisoners by the Pakistani authorities. Now, that's all about trying to improve ties between Pakistan and Afghanistan. The two have been on rather unfriendly terms because of Pakistan's influence in its backyard in Afghanistan. Now, the exchange last night was a rather different one. This was an internal Pakistan one, if you like, with the Pakistan Taliban and the army here in Pakistan exchanging prisoners. So we've got the Afghan Taliban and the Pakistan Taliban. Now, they are related in some ways, but also separate in other ways. And we've got a conflict here in Pakistan and one in Afghanistan, and both seem to be edging towards some sort of set of negotiations predicated on confidence-building measures, of which these exchanges are one part. Here in Pakistan, we have a new Prime Minister, Nawaz Sharif. He won elections earlier this year. And his government is talking up the possibility of talking to the Pakistan Taliban. At the same time, over in Afghanistan, as you know, we've had a long series of attempts at trying to find a negotiated settlement, a way of shoring up the government in Kabul ahead of the NATO withdrawal next year. So we're at a really crucial stage, both inside Pakistan, inside Afghanistan, but also in terms of the relations between the two countries. It's a horrendously complex mix, to be honest.
Rob, there have been some conflicting reports, though, over this supposed release of prisoners in Pakistan. The Taliban saying that this indeed did happen, but Pakistan's military service denying reports that this exchange happened.
Yeah, well, I'm at the same stage as you are. I haven't been able to get independent confirmation. It's hugely sensitive, and I could understand why the Pakistan government were unwilling to put this out in the open. You know, very often these types of negotiations are best done in secret. So I'm afraid, you know, I'm as confused as you are.
Well, on that note, Rob, let's turn to Shashank Joshi, who's in the studio with us. Shashank, just give us a sense of the current state of relations between Afghanistan and Pakistan. How do these prisoners and other moves towards reconciliation fit into the bigger picture?
Well, I think after a deterioration in ties last year, great deal of cross-border shelling, the Afghan parliament was absolutely incensed at what it saw as unprovoked firing, killing Afghan civilians from Pakistan. And of course, I've never seen as much anti-Pakistani sentiment in my life, including in India, as I have in Kabul, for obviously the historic reasons that Rob described. But I think the election of Nawaz Sharif has made a difference. I think he has changed the optics. And I think it would probably have been even better had we not had that absolutely bungled, catastrophic opening of the Taliban's Doha office, their political office, which was interpreted within some quarters in Afghanistan as yet another Pakistani effort to meddle and keep a tight Pakistani grip on the peace process. The Taliban exploited that, putting up their own flag, using their anthem, calling themselves the Islamic Emirate, and that really turned the Afghans off. And of course, this is an elections coming up. Karzai has to be very careful indeed. He isn't running, but he is still in a very tight political spot. So relations, in other words, are perhaps thawing, but still very frosty indeed, and subject to the vicissitudes of Afghanistan's own election process.
And in Pakistan, let's talk a bit about the relationship between the Taliban and the Pakistani government. When Sharif came into power, he said he would be willing to discuss peace plans with the Taliban. I'm just wondering, Shashank, how much of this is him playing politics in the fact that if he says he's going to have peace, if it doesn't work out, then he can go ahead and have that harsh crackdown, military, in a sense, hunt for these Taliban, which he, you know, previous governments have been criticized for going a bit too hard.
Well, for 2 points. First of all, I'm not even sure it's worth discussing the Pakistani Taliban in the same breath as the Afghan Taliban. They're so distinct, in my opinion. But if we do look at the TTP for a second, the Pakistani Taliban, I don't think it's politics. I think it's genuine. I think he was trying to chart his own course, trying to pull away from the military and their own uncompromising attitude towards the TTP. And of course, many people would also say Nawaz Sharif, his brother is chief minister of the Punjab, one might say heartland of Pakistani fundamentalism today, the home of Lashkar-e-Taiba. He himself is seen to be soft on Islamists. He seemed to be sympathetic to their cause, sympathetic to the idea, at least, that they're fighting a noble battle, that they're all patriotic Pakistanis. So, in other words, I'm not sure this is the precursor to a major crackdown. I think he genuinely wants to explore political options after a several years of unyielding violence.
Shashank, inflammatory tactics, as you were saying, on all sides. How hopeful are you that these peace talks will materialise?
Well, I don't think the Afghans have been inflammatory at all. I'm quite sympathetic to them. I think they've done this reasonably by the book. They've been open to saying, look, you'll set up an office in Doha, which is a pretty big deal for a country to allow an insurgent movement to set up an office in another country. And I think that they have played this quite carefully. Overall, though, I don't think anything's going to happen because there's just too much uncertainty over what's happening after 2014. And that will shape how far the Taliban's willing to go. And it will shape how far the Afghan government's willing to go because they don't know how strong their negotiating position will be. Will they have a staunch American support, American troops sitting there to protect them, and then they can negotiate in a very relaxed way? Or will they be on their own, backs to the wall? Will they therefore have to make big concessions and enlist Pakistan's help and therefore be nicer to Pakistan, which is in effect in some ways blackmailing Afghanistan. We don't know yet.
Shashank, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute here in the studio. And before that, Rob Crilly, the Telegraph's man in Pakistan. Many thanks to you both for joining us here in the studio. Now, tonight sees a brand new edition of our weekly show devoted to the cities we live in, The Urbanist. While the latest episode focuses on transient, cities are often just temporary shelters, fleeting homes where people flow in and out of. But what impact does this have?
In this preview, we're in London's Cricklewood neighbourhood, where it's not the people who are passing through, but in fact a mobile town square. Urban think tank Spacemakers have created the space to host a series of free events to engage the local community. Caught on the border of three boroughs, Cricklewood has a dearth of public meeting points. No library, no town hall, not even a single bench. This project seeks to remedy this and highlight the enduring importance of public space in the neighbourhood. To find out more, Annabel Bly caught up with the project's director, Tom James, at one of their events, the Galtymore Memorial Dance.
Cricklewood is a lovely place. It's an amazing community, but it's in northwest London, and what it hasn't got anything at all of is public space. There's not a single bench across the whole high street. There's no town square, there's no library, there's no town hall. There's nothing really apart from a very thin strip of pavement and a busy road. And that's because Cricklewood falls on the boundaries of three boroughs, Barnet, Camden, Brent, and they normally tend to keep all their nice stuff in the middle. And so we came with this idea of a mobile town square which could move between the few patches of wasteland that it does have, and basically using a combination of like a civic folly on wheels and then lots of furniture and tools and benches and all that sort of stuff, create these spaces in these different patches of wasteland.
Tom, got the mobile town square in front of us right now. Could you perhaps just describe the actual structure itself to me?
So the structure is a civic folly on wheels. It's basically a tiny little town hall built out of fake bricks, polyurethane bricks. People keep on coming up to touch it because they can't believe that it's not real bricks. It's 3 metres tall. It's got a clock tower on the top. It's got beautiful ornate guttering. It's got a bright pink bicycle. It's bicycle powered and bright pink doors on the back. Really, what it is a box on wheels in which all of the furniture and the umbrellas and the projector and the PA go. So basically, we transport everything between sites in that. So it's designed by a guy called Kieran Jones, and it's a very ornate solution to a very practical problem. We came with this idea of a mobile town square, and that sounds amazing, but what does it mean in practice? What is a town square? A town square is really a place to sit and something civic-y behind you. So that's what it is.
So you guys weren't originally commissioned to have this portable town square. How did that idea come about, and what were you originally meant to be doing?
Initially, we were asked to look at empty shops. Because of the success of Brixton Village, everyone wants us to go into empty buildings and make them aspirational and desirable. When we realised that there was no public space at all, it just seemed like a really good idea to actually try and create some. The first site we were looking at was this massive bit of wasteland where the Galtymore nightclub used to be. So the whole reason we're doing Irish dance tonight is because Irish dancing is always happening quickly. And we asked the landowner and he said no. So that left us with no option but to do something peripatetic.
And what is this patch of pavement that we're on at the moment?
Well, it's nothing really. It's a blocked off road next to the Broadway. It's got some bricks down, some nice stones, and it's got some nice trees, but again, it hasn't got a bench, so it's totally useless. And we've been here for 2 days so far, and we've realised that, like, just putting benches down means people want to use it.
And is it as simple as that, in terms of creating public space, putting some benches down?
I think what public space really needs is places to sit and people in it. Most of the time during the week, actually, we haven't got events. The whole point is we've just got some chessboards, some newspapers, some benches, and just to try and create a sort of social life of the space. The weekend we do the big events, and you know, that then gets people down to them. I think what's really interesting is it's sort of like a wider problem than just Cricklewood. Like, public space across London and across the UK is sort of dying out, and councils are really scared to provide it. They're really scared to provide benches because they think people are going to get drunk and lie on the benches and fall asleep. We just want to show that if you design a space well enough and if you bring people to it, it will be successful.
With the series of events going on this month, what are your hopes and aims for what's going to happen in Cricklewood after the mobile town square actually comes to an end?
What we really want is for the community organisations we're working with, like, to be able to have the proof suddenly it's actually, this is really good.
We've got some local ladies dancing in the background. What kind of reception have you had with the local public here in Cricklewood?
Yeah, it's been really good. People love the structure. Like, long term, the structure's going to stay here, which we're really excited about. We're going to probably have to lop the wheels off. As you can imagine, the health and safety nightmare. People really love the structure, but more than that, I think they just really love the idea of, like, of benches and chairs and doing something. There's loads of stuff happening here, and there's loads of... I think the most important thing to think about Cricklewood is that the people here are amazing, and there's loads of people who want it to be, you know, want this stuff to happen, and you can tell the people come in today, like, we've got 10 elderly ladies now dancing, and one of them's run off to get a Jive CD. And so people, when you give people opportunities to do it, they love it.
Yeah, it's just kind of creating that space for them to meet and engage with one another.
Totally, yeah. And the problem with Cricklewood is that there's no space to do it, you know. And so if we can just convince people that if there is space, it happens, and long term, people can start looking at getting a permanent space to do this.
That was Tom James, Cricklewood Town Square's project director, speaking to Annabel Blight for this weekend's edition of The Urbanist.
And of course, you can hear more from The Urbanist in this week's Century Special edition of the show that premieres tonight at 1900 hours London time, 1400 hours if you happen to be in Toronto.
Well, in the next half hour of the programme, we'll round up the news from Mali with our woman in Bamako, review the Italian press live in the studio, and we'll take a tour of the gardens of Kyoto with Dutch visual artist Jacqueline Hassink.
There is no difference between private and public because the sliding doors, they open and there are no windows and there is sort of no border. So I thought conceptually this is a really interesting type of space.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Chloe. The five permanent members of the UN Security Council have been meeting in New York to discuss a Russian plan for neutralising Syria's chemical weapons. Diplomats say early discussions on resolutions have begun. The International Committee of the Red Cross is calling on the United States and Russia to discuss the obstacles to delivering aid in Syria. They say their work's being hampered by government forces and opposition rebels. At least six soldiers have been killed in a double suicide bomb attack in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. Military staff are blaming what they call Islamist terrorist elements. Hundreds of candlelight vigils have been held across Chile to honour the thousands who were killed or who disappeared after a violent military coup ushered in General Augusto Pinochet's brutal dictatorship 40 years ago. The annual tribute to the victims of the September the 11th attacks has been lighting up the skies over New York. The city commemorated the 12th anniversary of the attacks with tribute lights sent up from Ground Zero. The anti-Islam pastor Terry Jones has been arrested on a felony charge in Florida after trying to burn nearly 3,000 copies of the Quran on a barbecue grill in a public park to mark the 12th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back at the top of the hour, 9 o'clock in the morning here in London for another check of your world headlines. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Chloe Potter. It is 16:33 in Kyoto, 8:33 here in London. Now, Dutch visual artist Jacqueline Hassink is well known for her work with economic power and its spaces, as seen in her book, The Table of Power.
But in her latest project, she visited the Japanese city of Kyoto, where she carried out a detailed photographic study of some of the enchanting traditional Japanese gardens that surround the city's Buddhist temples. Her exhibition, View Kyoto, opens on Friday at London's Wapping Project Bankside. Monocle researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke with Jacqueline Hassink, and he began by asking her what sparked her interest in the gardens of Kyoto.
Well, I do a lot of different projects, and indeed I'm very interested in economy. But at one point, I think in 2003, I started to do work in the fashion world, in the haute couture world in Paris. And I'm really interested in the identity of spaces, like what is a private and public space, and especially in the world that we're living in right now. This idea of private and public is, I think, extremely important and interesting. And so I photograph fitting rooms of in the haute couture world, which are sort of on the edge of private and public spaces. And when I was going to Japan, I think in 2001, I visited Kyoto and I went to these Japanese gardens. And it was just beautiful to see that in Japanese gardens, in the, when you go, are in the temple, sitting on the tatami and looking outside, there is no difference between private and public because the sliding doors, they open and there are no windows and there is sort of no border. So I thought conceptually this is a really interesting type of space. And that's why I sort of started to get into it.
When you first went to Kyoto, did you have this project in mind already?
No, no, not at all, not at all. I just, usually what happens in my work that I see something or I travel extensively, like maybe 6-7 months of the year. I'm not in New York, so I travel all over the world. And then I see things that are really fascinating to me and I start to connect the dots. And then at one point I get this idea and it's sort of bubbling in my, in, you know, and then at one point I think, oh, I have to do this, I have to do this. And that happened also in Kyoto. I kind of visited maybe 10 temples and then I thought this is a brilliant idea to kind of, you know, try to work on this.
Before we talk more about this project, what's your connection with Japan? You just told me that your assistant thinks you're half Japanese.
Yes, I have a wonderful assistant, Noriko Kanda. And she said after maybe 3 years, we visited the temple. Usually we go very early in the morning at 7 o'clock. And then after the shoot, we have a cup of coffee. And then she said very quietly, I think, you know, Jacqueline, I think you are half Japanese. You're born Japanese in a previous life. And it's probably because I really understand the Japanese way of thinking. And yeah, I feel very at home there. It's like really, I feel great happiness when I'm in Kyoto or in Japan.
And talking about those gardens in Kyoto, I know you had some difficulties in photographing some of them.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, most of them. Because in general, if you, for example, when we go back to the boardroom series, if I call Citigroup or another huge corporation in the US or in Europe, you go to a certain protocol and at one point you get like, you know, like they say, okay, you can photograph or not. But in Japan, you really need to have introduction. You cannot just call a big company like Nissan and say, hey, I want to photograph your boardroom. Or in the temples in Kyoto, I just, you know, you go to a monk and say, let's shoot the garden. You really need to have an introduction. And Kyoto, as the old capital of Japan, has such a closed-off society that it's extremely difficult to get in there. So you need to have the proper introduction from a Kyoto person who really contact the monk, and then you have to send a letter of, you know, this is a very long process. So it was really, really difficult.
Can you describe a typical garden that you've visited? I'm sure each one of them is different, but
well, the beauty of the gardens in Kyoto and these Zen Buddhist gardens, those are gardens that are originally used for meditation. So one enters a building that's often very old and made of wood, and then you sit on a tatami mat, and the viewing is very important. So if we stand and look at the garden, one cannot experience it in the same way as when you sit, you know, you go through your knees. And that's exactly how the garden design is supposed to be. You look at the garden and then very often you have a gravel field or you have beautiful moss, you know, decorations. And all these gardens, they tell a certain tale. There are 1,500 temples in Kyoto. So you can imagine how many different gardens. And then on top of it, the changing of the season is extremely important in the garden. So if you look at January or you look at the cherry blossom season, or there's a shift all the time, which makes them, you know, it's in Japan, it's really important and makes them so beautiful also.
Do you have a favorite garden?
Yes, I think that Taihoji or Kokodera, it's a temple where it's a stroll garden where you, or a paradise garden where you walk through, and there are about, I think, 120 different types of moss. And when you really walk in that garden, you sometimes really feel you are in paradise. It's exquisite. And Rengeji, it's a very small temple in the northern part of Kyoto, which people don't really know, but it's exquisite. And I can sit there for hours just looking.
And I just want to talk about your new exhibition, I mean, here in London as well, which is opening on Friday. And what will be able to see at this exhibition?
We will see a couple of major pieces, quite big photographs. But on top of it, we also have the first time I'm showing a film that I did in 2011, it's a diptych in which I interview four monks. My sister Noriko Kanda, she interviewed the monks. And then on the right side, we see, you know, the garden. So this is a very unique kind of moment that the film has never been shown in the world. So it's a very special moment.
Fantastic. And then you're going to release, will there be like a book or something? Like,
yes,
it's be
definitely.
Released?
No. My publisher in Germany, Hatje Kans, and maybe in collaboration with Aperture in New York, are going to release the book in the fall next year. And then we also have a big show at Huis Marseille in Amsterdam. And then I'm sure this work will travel.
And what are your next projects besides Kyoto?
Well, I'm about to leave. I'm now in Europe for a month, and then I go to China in October. And then I'm working on a project that has to deal with the use of the internet, the iPhone, and I'm sort of playing with that. But it's kind of it's starting, and I'm sure in a year or two.
You're going to be here again talking to us
maybe.
About that.
Yes, yes, it's possible, yeah.
That was Dutch visual artist Jacqueline Hassink there chatting to Fernando Augusto Pacheco about the beauty of Kyoto. I've never been, Chloe, but hopefully one day I will.
Yeah, hopefully after that.
I heard they're absolutely stunning.
Yes. Both of us sitting here wishing with all our might. You're listening to Midori House, and up next we'll be talking to our woman in Mali.
Monocle 24 is hitting the road this week and then parking up in Frankfurt. The briefing will be coming to you live on Friday from the International Motor Show, the biggest such event of the year in Europe. Join me, Tom Edwards, and Monocle's transport editor, Tristan McAllister, as the latest electric hybrids battle with a crew of brand new SUVs to gain our attention at the Messe. We'll hear from the biggest names behind the most celebrated brands and also talk trends in automotive style, urban design and innovation. That's The Briefing, live from the International Motor Show on Friday at 1300 hours in Frankfurt, 12 midday London time.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 8:42 here in London, 7:42 in Bamako, which is where we head now to speak to Alex Duval-Smith. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Thank you. Good morning.
Now, you've got a rather dramatic story centred around jewels to kick us off today.
Well, yes. In the Central African Republic, the interim president, Michel Djotodia, has just fired the director of the Treasury, Jules Alex Keté, accusing him of stealing the equivalent of the crown jewels. Now, I don't know, Chloe, what's the name of that gong that mayors and governors wear? It's a band across the chest with a bow on the end and a medal. There must be a name for that kind of decoration.
There must be. I do not know it off the top of my head, Alex, but we've all got a clear picture of what you're talking about.
We've all got one. No, we haven't, that's the thing. And, of course, Djotodia needed one for his inauguration. So he spoke to the Treasury, and the Treasury Director, Jules-Alex Keté, ordered one. Or so it seemed, on the 18th of August, when Djotodia was inaugurated, he was wearing a gong, and it still transpired, or at least this is what Djotodia alleges, that it was a fake, and that Keté, in cahoots with a Senegalese jeweller, produced a fake and pocketed all or some of the €910,000 value of the gong.
And Alex, Keté has a bit of a record, though, when it comes to stealing things.
Sorry, the line went?
Keté has a bit of a record, though, when it comes to being accused of stealing things.
He does indeed, and I don't know enough about the man to really understand why he's still in the job, because in 2011 he was accused of stealing €3 million that had been destined for the establishment of Salatu, a public transport provider. That was an Indian firm which came in with plans for public transport for Bongi, for the Central African Republic, and the money disappeared and there still is no public transport.
Alex, coming to Mali now, elections held last month, a new cabinet of 34 ministers appointed. What is the current security situation in the country?
Well, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, as you mentioned, was elected on the 11th of August. He appointed a cabinet of 34 ministers, considered a bloated cabinet, a bit larger than poor, impoverished Mali needs at this time. On the other hand, there's a lot of work to do. France still has 3,000 troops in the country, and the United Nations is deploying its force, which is due to grow to 12,000 by the end of the year. And, of course, the big challenge facing Keita and the new government will be how to handle the north. That's what everyone's going to be looking. That's where the trouble came from. The secessionist Tuareg rebels, who at a point actually allied with Islamist rebels to create the very unstable situation in the north. Keita has said, the first thing he said when he appointed his cabinet on Monday was that he's going to convene national assizes to discuss the north. He has 60 days to do so under the Ouagadougou agreement, which was signed in June and made the elections possible. Under the Ouagadougou agreement, the Tuareg rebels laid down their arms, said, okay, let's have elections and then we'll talk. So that's what we're all waiting for. And of course, if no appeasement is found, if no deal is made, there's always this danger that the rebels will take up arms again, because they're still there, even though they have gone to ground.
And Alex, it sounds like you're on the very busy streets of Bamako there. I'm just wondering, have you started to notice any flying insects around your face?
Well, not actually here. Yes, I am on a busy street in Bamako, but all the streets in Bamako are always like this, mostly with motorbikes. But these flying insects are the locusts that we're warned are on their way to the region. The Algerian Institute for the Protection of Vegetation, the only institute of its nature in the Sahel and Sahara region, has warned that locusts are hatching. Locusts are a sort of annual pest, but the pest is not always as severe as the Algerians are warning it might be this year. The locusts, when they come in a sort of rainstorm of black horror and eat everything in a matter of minutes. Of course, the last thing that Mali needs, as it's just trying to get everybody to try and go back to the north of the country, and the locusts would be coming from the Sahara, where they've been hatching allegedly in the recent rains. We've had very heavy rains, and OCHA, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, has confirmed that a high rate of larva, 750 locusts per hectare, a calculation they consider high. And of course, if you've got 750 locusts, you've got even more larva.
Oh, Alex, that sounds—it's horrible. It's very early in the morning here. But Alex, we can't let you go without hearing about the training that you've been having recently. You've been taught how to cope with a kidnapping. Tell us about that.
Well, yes, and in fact, that's the reason I've been on a busy street, because I've been rushing to a rendezvous, after which later this morning I'm expected to be kidnapped. I'm at a hotel, the Hotel El Farouk, waiting to meet a group of trainees from the United Nations. I've been given this training because, as a journalist who wants to travel to the north with the United Nations, I have to have it under United Nations rules. So it's basically hostile environment training, where they give you an idea of the security situation in the north, and which is easy to forget when you're in Bamako, because it's quite a quiet city, apart from the traffic. We've been given interesting insights into how the situation is seen in the north. The UN, for example, has started a demining operation trying to get a clear unexploded ordnance And there's a lot of it around, a lot of homemade bombs. We were told about one particular device yesterday that is basically explosive packed into a tin can with a small metal plate on the end. And when it's detonated, that small metal plate fires out of the tin can and can pierce an armored vehicle at a very high speed and at a temperature of 1,500 degrees, which means that everyone in the armored vehicle gets fried. Now, that, of course, concentrates the mind when you're on a course. And as I mentioned, yes, I'm about to perhaps be the victim of a kidnap. There are 29 other people who could also be picked out as the potential victim.
Goodness me, Alex, unfortunately, we've run out of time, so you're going to have to come back on the show to tell us what you learn on the kidnapping course. But good luck.
Find a safe corner and hide. Don't let them get you.
I'll try. Any trick in the book.
Alex Duval-Smith in Mali for us there.
Talk about a busy Thursday morning for Alex. She's like dodging locusts, invasions of locusts, simulated kidnappings from the UN. That sounds very hectic indeed. Well, in just a moment, we'll be reviewing this morning's Italian front pages with David Pleasant. But before all that, this is Postcards from Italy by Beirut.
The times we had, oh, when the wind would blow with rain or snow, were not all bad. We put our features where they had to go.
Listening to Midori House. I'm so sorry, Phil.
Well, I was just such a fan of that song that I wanted to mention the band so they get as much publicity as possible. That was the American band there, Beirut, with Postcards from Italy.
So, next up, it's time to review the Italian front pages. And joining us in the studio is Monocle researcher David Pleasant. David, what do you have to kick us off this morning?
Well, before all of you heave a sigh of pain and annoyance, I have to start with Berlusconi, because there is kind of the latest with that. The La Repubblica is leading with the last fight from Berlusconi, and and lots of the other papers are as well. So the Senate has decided to adjourn the final decision on whether to ban him from public service on the adjourn that until the 19th of October. So it looks like there's going to be some kind of reckoning on that, because it's going on and on. I mean, various people in his party and on the other side have said that they're really tired of this.
He's getting to be a bit of an old man and a bit of a pest around the political circles, isn't he? Why doesn't he just say goodbye?
Well, there's so much at stake, I think, that it's kind of his legacy and also the rest of the kind of prosecutions that he might face. The media set indictment that was made on the 1st of August is just the tip of the iceberg, really. So there's all sorts of other potential prosecutions. Most kind of prominently the kind of sex claims that against him. So I think he has plenty to lose.
And as a result of that, he's looking to take this all the way, as it were.
Yeah, he said that as a kind of final plea, he's also said that he's willing to take this to the European Court of Human Rights. He feels he's been so, his rights have been so violated.
Extraordinary.
Well, from one man with perhaps loose ethics to another man with slightly higher moral standing.
Well, one would hope so. this is a kind of, I've got the two covers of the La Repubblica here. This was yesterday. The Pope actually wrote a letter to the editor of the La Repubblica, Eugenio Scalfari, and this was a reply to a kind of a moral debate that the paper was having earlier in the summer. And the Pope has wrote a letter which was titled "His Letter to the Those Who Don't Believe, to the Non-Believers," and it's quite an interesting, very kind of soft approach that the Pope is taking, like he seems to be quite regularly now. He says, I have to thank you, first of all, this is to the editor, for the excellent debate that you started. And I'm only too happy to engage in this kind of conversation.
It's another sign, isn't it, David, that Pope Francis is proudly taking a very new approach with the papacy.
Exactly. I mean, I think week after week, we're seeing this incredible engagement on the part of the Pope. I wouldn't say the Vatican as a whole. I think he's just kind of going alone with this. Mm. There was another story that some listeners might have heard and is still in a lot of the papers about the Pope being offered a white Renault 4 that had clocked up 300,000 kilometres on the clock, a kind of battered old car by a fellow priest. He was offered this at the weekend and he took it gladly and took it for a spin around the Vatican gardens.
And this is the same man, of course, that during his time in Argentina would always take the local bus, wouldn't he, and speak to parishioners.
Exactly.
He certainly seems to have a sense of fun, Pope Francis.
Yeah, he does. I don't know what the kind of... I mean, the reaction seems to be very kind of good in the Italian press, I have to say. I'm not sure what the kind of repercussions of this might be with the more conservative side of the church. But so far, he's certainly making good stories for journalists in Italy.
And David, very quickly, the Cosa Concordia, after all this time there on its side, maybe finally raised, back upright.
Yeah, that's right. La Repubblica has a piece on that. And they've set a date, well, actually Monday, for it to be rotated. A huge process to do that. Many people will know about that the cruise ship that sunk over a year ago, well, half submerged off the coast of Tuscany. This has been kind of a blight in the side of Italy. It's seen as a great kind of shame, and obviously the legal repercussions of the captain. But finally, this complex engineering process will start on Monday. Although the cameras are going to be banned as a kind of respect to some of the passengers and the bodies that still remain on the ship.
David, thank you. That was a good whiz around the Italian papers there. All we have time for today, unfortunately. Thanks to our producer, Barbara Feeney, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Anna Falco, and our studio manager, Bill Luti.
Up next, after the news, is the 100th edition of Culture with Robert Bound. I'll be back with Poppy Trowbridge at the same time tomorrow for another edition of Midori House. But from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Chloe Potter.
Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We'll be right back.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.